It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up in just a minute, it's time for Food Friday. We'll get the lowdown on cheesecake.
But first, President Trump and congressional leaders came to an agreement today to temporarily fund and reopen the government, ending the longest partial shutdown in U.S. history. Lawmakers have until February 15th to reach an agreement to fund a border wall.
Craig Gilbert is a political reporter and Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you.
Well, in a nutshell, Craig, what is in this agreement?
Well, it's an agreement that should look familiar to people because it was out there weeks earlier, basically funding the government, in this case, only for a few more weeks, without any kind of resolution of the debate over border wall, no strings attached from the perspective of Democrats in terms of making a commitment to the kind of wall money that President Trump is asking for. So the Democrats, I think, are widely perceived as sort of winning this game of chicken, and President Trump as having blinked. The Democratic position has been that we're not going to negotiate wall funding or border security with the government shut. And President Trump relented in the end.
And President Trump talked today about this deal just this afternoon. He renewed his call for wall funding, saying it was necessary for the government ultimately to stay open after this deal passes. Here's what he said.
If we don't get a fair deal from Congress, the government will either shut down on February 15th again, or I will use the powers afforded to me under the laws and the Constitution of the United States to address this emergency.
We've heard this idea of the president potentially declaring a national emergency at the southern border. Critics saying, well, if we've made it this far without declaring it, and if we can go another few weeks without it, is it really an emergency? What's the talk of the town on this emergency declaration idea, Craig?
Well, I think, you know, there's a couple of problems there. One is just the legality of it, and I think it would end up in court if it happened. And two, there's certainly not universal support among Republicans for this kind of move, because some conservatives, a fair number of conservatives, have concerns about the use of executive power when it comes to what President Trump is talking about and see it as an overreach. So I don't think we can rule it out, but it's certainly comes with its own set of complications and negatives, just as the shutdown did.
You wrote just in the last day or so, Craig, about how some Wisconsin lawmakers were reacting to this and some behind-the-scenes confrontations in the U.S. Senate. What have you been hearing?
Well, there was a closed door. You know, the parties retreat behind closed doors to have internal discussions around big issues, and there was a Republican luncheon yesterday before the votes, this pair of shutdown votes we had in the Senate yesterday. And it was reported first by the Washington Post that there was kind of a confrontation between Ron Johnson, the Republican senator from Wisconsin, and Republican and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, where Johnson confronted him. The Post reported that he said, "This is your fault." What Johnson says he said is, "You put us in this position." What he was apparently referring to was not the shutdown is your fault, but he didn't like the way the Senate was handling it. He didn't like what happened yesterday with these two votes where the Senate voted on two bills that were kind of destined to fail because neither one was going to get the 60 votes that controversial items need in the Senate to pass. And Johnson's also frustrated because he had a bill to pay the federal workers that are actually working without pay, and he hasn't been able to get complete buy-in from his own party, and he hasn't been able to get buy-in from Democrats, and he hasn't been able to get a vote on it. All those things are going on, but I think it's also just symptomatic of the larger sort of mood of frustration among Republicans in the Senate. They've been on the sidelines. The shutdown was precipitated by the White House. They see the politics. It's not popular. And so there's a lot of angst among Senate Republicans about this issue, and you saw it in the fact that you know, a bunch of Senate Republicans crossed over and voted for the Democratic plan, which contained no funding, none of the funding the president wanted for the border wall, even though that vote failed on Thursday.
We'll leave it there for now, Craig, with the shutdown temporarily resolved, but the underlying issues still wide open. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be with you.
That's Craig Gilbert, political reporter and Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to give us a quick update on the temporary agreement to reopen the government for at least the next few weeks.
Now it's time for Food Friday. Cheesecake is one of the most decadent and popular desserts around, but a lot of us might think making a great cheesecake at home is just too much of a challenge.
But with the right techniques and some practice, there are hundreds of different varieties you can make for friends, family, or just yourself.
And if there's anyone in the world that's baked more cheesecakes than our next guest, well, good luck finding them.
George Geary is a chef, author, and culinary educator who spent years making cheesecake, including for television's The Golden Girls. His latest cookbook is the second edition of the Cheesecake Bible. George, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, it's great to be back. How are you all?
Well, good. And George, you've cooked a lot of different things in your lifetime, but you have legitimately, you may be the person who's cooked more cheesecake than any other human on the face of the earth. How did cheesecake become your thing?
I have no idea. It was by accident, honestly. I just, you know, everybody has something, and I passionately love chocolate. And I was trained as a pastry chef. But then I started looking at cheesecake differently than what was out there in books and things like that. And I took the knowledge of making about 300 cheesecakes a day when I was Disneyland's pastry chef to the home. And I just was sick and tired of listening to people tell you how you can create it from cracking and nothing working. So I thought, you know what? There needs to be a book out there. So I did my first book 12 years ago on cheesecake, and I've had three since.
Well, George, you released the original Cheesecake Bible over 12 years ago, and now you've expanded it into this second edition. Does it still surprise you to this day just how many varieties of cheesecake you can put together?
Yeah, I added another 150 to the new book.
Wow.
Then I started seeing different chain restaurants like IHOP do cheesecake pancakes and things like that. And I thought, huh, I could put this into the new book, too. So it's a cheesecake plus sweet and savory recipes for cheesecakes and more. So you've got a lot more things in there, different muffins and things like that. There's a whole chapter on breakfast foods.
George, you mentioned the whole cracking issue, and that for home cooks is the biggest frustration with cheesecakes. I'll eat them. They still taste the same. People can dump them off on me if they don't like how they look. But what is the solution to help keep cheesecakes from cracking in the oven?
You have to read the first two chapters of my book. No, honestly, I only get about 85% non-cracking. And everybody has their own way of doing it, and they think it works. And really, 85%, I'm pretty good at it. I feel that if it does crack, you just put whipped cream on top. And if anybody judges your baking, don't invite them over. And that's kind of – because I've never heard somebody go, oh, that cracked.
We're not going to eat it.
And yeah, and there's a big chain of restaurants named something with that word. And if you look at all theirs, they have a topping of some sort on every single one of their cheese.
Aha!
And so that's a little bit of a secret. I've done some consulting for that company. And they also – I see my favorite thing is the way you use the oven. And people will say, you put it in the oven at 500 degrees, you turn it off, and you let it sit there overnight. Could you imagine Disneyland having ovens just for cheesecakes that could sit all night long? And we couldn't do it. And nobody wants to make a recipe that's going to take longer than, you know, for a baking, an hour is the max for somebody. So I just created this different way of, I don't use a water bath. You hear that all the time. A water bath is another pan that it sits in to create steam. And people say, oh, that'll prevent cracking. It doesn't. I've done both tests both ways. So I took the water bath completely out of the situation because I want people to get into the kitchen. It doesn't take a whole lot to do a cheesecake. And I really think that if you follow my techniques, which isn't anything strange, it's making sure all the ingredients are room temperature, incorporating the eggs in one at a time. Don't just dump them all into the cream cheese. Don't bake over 350. That and overbaking is probably the number one reason why things crack. I even read in the newspaper article, somebody quoted me, which was incorrect just this past week, that adding a like chocolate into it will create it to crack. And I thought, no, that's crazy. You know, so you got to have chocolate in cheesecake sometimes. So. So there's just all these little factors that equal a pretty good cheesecake. But I would say number one is overbaking.
Now, George, as a cheesecake lover myself, one of the keys for me has always been the crust. And I know that crust is something that you can play around with quite a bit. But how do you go about matching the crust to the flavor of the filling?
Well, that was a new thing in this book, too. I used to just say use Oreo cookies or use lemon sandwich cookies for a lemon cheesecake. And I started finding people couldn't find lemon cookies, or they found them and they were really expensive, you know, gourmet lemon shortbreads or something that was $4 for a box, and, you know, you might as well buy a cheesecake after a while. So the first chapter in the new book, some people call it the New Testament, since it's the Bible, has a whole chapter on making your own cookies. If you really want to go crazy, you could go ahead and use Oreos or make this chocolate cookie I have in there. I kind of give you a hint on what cookie goes best or crust goes best with which cheesecake. Your typical is graham cracker. And the other thing with regular recipes I'll see is graham crackers, sugar, butter, and you bake it. I took that out also. Why are we putting sugar in the cookie crust? We already have it sweetened, so there's an ingredient I don't need to add into my recipe. And why are we baking it? The proteins of the cookie crumbs are already baked out, so, and they're going to bake in the cheesecake some more. So I don't bake the cheesecake ahead of time. And if you look at all the pictures in the book, I don't go up the sides of the pan. I just do the bottom and that's it. Because if you go up the sides, you get like a big thickness between the side and the bottom of the cheesecake. And some people can't get their fork in there and they just leave it. And that was a test thing when I was at Disney at our private club. After the weekend and I was off on Monday and Tuesday, I'd go in and the chef would say, "No one's eaten the sides of your cheesecake. What's wrong with it?" And then I realized the fork couldn't get through the crust, so why waste all that time and energy of going up the sides and trying to scrape it out? So that's why. So that's about how we do the crust. I kind of pair it up. Fall, I use a lot of ginger snaps, graham crackers for your typical cheesecakes. And then chocolate, if I've got something chocolate or mocha-based, lemon if it's a citrus base, or something of that nature.
We're talking with George Geary right now, a chef and author of the Cheesecake Bible.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how to make a great cheesecake? Are there problems you've run into? What do you wish you knew about making cheesecake when you started? Or do you simply have a favorite type of cheesecake you want to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got three recipes that George shared with us. You can find them at wpr.org/foodfriday.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. We're continuing our chat with Chef George Geary right now. He's the author of the Cheesecake Bible.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 on this edition of Food Friday. Do you have a favorite cheesecake to make or to eat? Are you a pro when it comes to cheesecake, or do you need some advice from George on getting it right? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, George, I want to talk about one of the recipes you've shared with us. We've got them at wpr.org/foodfriday. One is a caramel pecan cheesecake. Pretty straightforward. I want to hear about this Maui tropical cheesecake you gave us. This sounds like a fun thing to eat on, I don't know, a day when the temperature's not going to hit zero in Wisconsin.
I'm so sorry about your temperature today.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Southern California with orange trees blossoming right now.
Yeah, rub it in.
No capped mountains. So, yeah, I have a short sleeve shirt on. My people I know, because I work in almost every state of the union, they don't like me when I post on Instagram. But the tropical Maui cheesecake, I put that together after going to some of the South Pacific Islands, because I was in Fiji and in Samoa and America Samoa, and they do these different cheesecakes down there with a lot of their fresh fruits and stuff. And I know you can't get fresh pineapple everywhere, so we use canned pineapple in it, and we use papaya for the decoration and stuff. And it's really, really flavorful. And you think you're kind of healthy because you've got all this fruit in it, even though it's got a lot of cream cheese. And I put macadamia nuts as the crust. And this one's a little bit different from the one that with using cookies, because you're using macadamia nuts and some flour to bind it together. And you toast those ahead of time with some sugar, and then you put that together. So it's a really flavorful cheesecake.
That sounds great. Let's go to our callers now. We've got Pat on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Pat, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Pat?
I'm attempting to master the cheesecake with a raspberry glaze and then covered with chocolate ganache. But I just can't seem to get the ganache right. It always seems to be too thin and it doesn't harden up. What am I doing wrong?
Oh, that, you know, that's a good question, a ganache problem. And I always, when I was being trained by a French pastry chef, when he'd say ganache, it had such a thick accent that I kept thinking he was sneezing. So I'd say, bless you, and he'd look at me and think I was crazy. But the ganache recipe that I use, I think I have one in the cheesecake book, it's equal chocolate as it is to heavy cream. So what I do is, I look at the chocolate. Now the problem is with what you're probably having is because chocolate percentages have changed over the years, and they give us the numbers on the packaging. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be bittersweet, semi-sweet, and milk chocolate, and that's about it. Now you've got all these percentages. So I would use a 60% chocolate, and the amount that you use, if you use 8 ounces of chocolate in weight, I'd use 8 ounces of regular heavy cream. And put the chocolate in a dish, chop it up, take the heavy cream, don't stir it, put it in a saucepan till it starts stand right next to it. It comes up the sides and starts almost going over. Pour it into the chocolate and stir it, and then add a tablespoon of butter, a little bit of liqueur if you want, just a tablespoon at the most. Stir it until it gets very melted. It'll look like hot chocolate for a while, and then it'll keep it'll bind together. And at that point, you can use it and pour it. And you could let it sit just for a little bit to where it firms up just a tad. If it firms up too much, you want it to firm up on your cheesecake, not in the bowl. So if you make it in the morning and you think you're going to use it in the afternoon, you'll have to put it on a double boiler and with some steam and mix it, because you don't want to put it on direct heat. So that should work for you.
Thanks for the call, Pat. Let's go to Mark in Wauwatosa. Good afternoon, Mark. Welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call. So years ago, my mother mother and aunts used to get these little recipe cards from this dairy delivery guy. And one was for a baked cheesecake, and the other was for a frozen cheese tart. And it had the baker's cheese and, you know, egg yolks folded in. And it was never baked. It was frozen, but it was wonderful. It was like our Easter time treat. It was very fluffy. You know, it had the gelatin in it to kind of get everything to coalesce a little bit. And I was just wondering what George's take was on the frozen cheese tart.
What my take on see, that's where they use gelatin instead of eggs to firm it up. And I had in my very first cheesecake book, I had some gelatin based. I think I still have some in this one too. And it's a different flavor and texture. What you have is memories of childhood and things like that. And I tried to put that into the books and all the books I do, because people do remember those types of cheesecake. It might not be the favorite of somebody else's, but it is of yours. So I've done many cheesecakes like that, that we use a gelatin as and then you freeze it also, the whole thing, and then you sometimes you eat it right frozen. Was yours eaten frozen?
Yes, it was frozen, and I think it was frozen because it That sort of helped with the eggs, because there were eggs in this, and it's actually I've made it
there was some.
Years since. Yeah, yeah, but it's very light and fluffy, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, it yeah, and it's those memories that we just love that we need to keep.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. I wanted to ask George before we run out of time. You've got a whole chapter on savory cheesecakes. We've got one of those at WPR.org/Food Friday. You also have one like a lobster cheesecake, which just sounds weird. Sell us on this idea of non-dessert cheesecakes, of the savory stuff.
Well, when I was teaching in Texas, I was testing recipes back 18 years ago, thinking, is this book going to work? Because that's what I do first, is I take it on the road before I bring a book out. And some lady, she says, is this like a cheese ball? And I was like, no, it's not like a cheese ball. Because no one had really heard of baked cheesecakes back then. And I was kind of hoping that company that I did some consulting for would bring on some baked cheesecakes. If you bring a savory baked cheesecake to a party, people will think, wow, what is it? Because people kind of get tired of the same thing as appetizers or as a first course. So the one that we have on the website is the herb cheesecake.
Yeah.
And we're just using some fresh herbs. And it doesn't have a whole lot of sweetness in it. It has a little bit of sugar, just a little bit, and some egg. And it's baked. The crackers that I use for the crust are the same crackers that you'll dip into. So if you use a stone ground cracker, which is listed in the book if you want to make one or buy them, and then you put crackers around like a little 6-inch cheesecake and you dig into it, almost like a cheese spread almost, but it is baked. I do have a few that aren't baked, but I have like a pistachio blue cheese cheesecake that's phenomenal. And the lobster one that you mentioned, I joked and I said, if you have lobster left over, you can make this cheesecake. And my editor said, who has lobster left over? Are you crazy? So I don't know if we kept that in, but...
No, it's still there.
Okay. So it just has a different factor. I love taking them or serving them. The number one savory cheesecake in the book is, and nobody knew what they were at the time, 18 years ago, Chipotle chili cheesecake.
Ooh.
And it's got a little bit of a spice to it and a kick, and it's got some tomatoes and some herbs and the Chipotle chilies. And people are like, what are Chipotle chilies? And now chains are using that in their hamburgers and stuff. But it really is a great cheesecake.
Sounds great. George, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's George Geary, chef and author. We've been talking about his new book, the second expanded edition of the Cheesecake Bible. You can find a few of the recipes we talked about online at WPR.org/Food Friday. There's been a lot of effort lately to get younger people educated and interested in the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math.
At the same time, there's been growing awareness that some groups of people are underrepresented in those fields at the college and professional levels, including people of color.
Our next guest is working to turn that around in Milwaukee and beyond as a tutor, a teacher, and a mentor. Sharif Jackson is the founder of the math and physics tutoring service Math Looks Good, LLC, and adjunct professor at UW-Whitewater. He joined us in our Milwaukee studio. Sharif, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. I'm trying to stay warm.
Everybody is. Now, before we get, Sharif, to the specific work you do, I think a lot of people might say, I'm just not good at math. I'm not a math person. I'm not into numbers. How would you encourage people in general to just maybe give math another chance?
Well, I usually tell people that things like math and science are like learned skills. So it's kind of like a sport. Like there are some people that are born with some gifts, but if they don't practice them and use them, then they won't be great at it. Math and science is the same thing. I mean, like, sure, you have some, like, you know, your Einsteins and such that have some natural gifts, but you have to use it. So it's really like a practice makes perfect kind of thing.
Now, math and science can look intimidating to anyone. What extra obstacles do you see for children of color when it comes to getting into the STEM topics, the science, technology, engineering, and math?
I mean, I think that the biggest thing to me is not seeing a lot of examples and role models from areas that they are from. You know, and like I can definitely identify with that, because when I was in college, you know, I did not see a lot of professors of color, and I didn't see that many students of color either. So it's kind of a vicious cycle where, because you don't see those examples, you kind of subconsciously believe that you can't make it or it's not for you. You know, so I think that, you know, that's why I like to put the effort into try to break that cycle and to let people know that, you know, that there are lots of examples out there, and that it is something that anybody can achieve.
That's a message that maybe kids themselves get. Is there also kind of a built-in bias in our society for the grown-ups in a kid's life, where they might look at, say, an African-American kid and just not look at that person as a math or science person?
For sure. I think that, you know, I think for a lot of us, if you say the word doctor or engineer or astronaut, you know, usually what pops up is a very stereotypical, like, older white male, you know, with a tweed jacket or like a nice beard. I definitely think that bias is kind of built in because of the position that people of a color have been putting in this country for like so long. So I think that, you know, those are images, and we know that they're not real, but they still hold weight, especially emotional weight. So I think that bias is there just because of the history.
What do we miss out on as a society if we have this potential talent pool in fields like math and science and computer programming? I mean, the list goes on, engineering. If we've got this potential talent pool and they don't get a chance, they don't get exposed to these fields.
I mean, we miss out on the best ideas. I mean, you know, time and time again, like, we've seen that the best ideas come from companies that have the most diverse set of, like, voices. Like, you need a lot of different experiences, especially when you're designing products, to like avoid, you know, any like blind spots. You know, you need people of color of your team on your team. You need women on your team. You need people of different gender backgrounds and orientations on your team, because like that is what is going to help you make the best product that takes into account the most people's perspectives. So I think that at the end of the day, if we don't encourage like diversity on our teams, then we're not going to get the best products.
Talking to Sharif Jackson, founder of the math and physics tutoring service Math Looks Good in Milwaukee. We're talking about bringing math, science, and related fields to diverse communities. Sharif, when you work as a tutor, I know you've worked in classrooms as well. How do you try to be a part of fixing this problem?
Well, I think one big thing that I always try to do is I try to use examples of scientists that are diverse. I think often we tend to focus on the same kind of pillars of the scientific age, like Isaac Newton and Galileo and Albert Einstein. And like, don't get me wrong, they should definitely be mentioned and like a focus on for sure. But like, science is a process that has been contributed to by various countries and like people of like various backgrounds. And I definitely try to like a focus on that. And I've talked to like a kids that like have like said, you know, like, I never knew that, you know, that algebra was an Arabic word, or I never knew that like our numbers came from European countries, you know? So I think it's all about like showing the balance and global nature of what science like is, and like doing that via examples helps a lot.
You mentioned growing up, even into college, not maybe seeing people who looked like you going into these fields. Can you share your own story of what made you get into math and science fields?
Sure. So when I was a kid, this is something that my parents loved, I would just take things apart. I would take the remote control apart. I would take the microwave apart. I would try to take the massive wooden Zenith TV apart. I don't know, it was just a challenge. Like I kind of thought about it like a Lego set, so I always tried to take things apart and put them back together. I was not always successful, but it was something that I just thought was just fun. I never knew that it was something that was actually this career called engineering where you build things and take things apart. So, you know, as I found out that the rules behind how these things were like built actually depends on like mathematical and scientific principles, that's what got me more into those classes because it could help me to build things and destroy things. That's, you know, it's like one of those things where I think that a lot of times when you're younger, you don't see the things that you're passionate about or the things that you do for fun as connected to any kind of like career as like as an adult. So I'm lucky that I had some mentors and some people in my life that helped me to make that connection.
You also teach and talk about video games playing and I think creating them. Can that be an entry point to help get people into STEM fields?
Yeah, it's a huge entry point. You know, like the video game community is like, it's like very diverse and it's a mainstream thing at this point. I mean, like games are not this side thing like they were in the 1980s. I mean, like it is mainstream culture. So I think that almost everyone, even if you've only played like a phone game, you know, or like a game on your Apple TV or your Roku box, you've played a game, you know? So I think that teaching people that they don't only have to be consumers, but they can actually participate in the industry. And that doesn't always mean that like you have to be a programmer. You can be a marketer, you can be a designer, you could be a PR person, you can be a narrative person that just focuses on the story and the dialogue. There's like so many avenues that can go toward creating this like medium that, you know, is still relatively new. Especially when like compared to like, you know, to television and like radio and like as such. I think it's a great entry point, not only for us STEM, but for a lot of like different fields.
I was at an event at my kid's high school the other day, and part of the goal was to get diverse students from all backgrounds to take advanced placement classes, science, English, across the board. The adults talked about, you know, helping with getting into college and that sort of thing. And then they brought up some kids, and every one of them used a phrase, something like, I wanted to do this to test myself. I wanted to see what my limits were. They talked about these advanced academic classes like people talk about athletics or going into the military. Is that part of how we need to frame it? It's not just, this is a career opportunity. This is about seeing what you can do?
I think that there's some pros and cons to that. I do think that if you are the kind of personality that wants to test yourself, I think that that's fine. But I think that you run into the danger of overdoing it. And I've definitely worked with students that are taking, you know, way too many APs and they're very stressed out and they're staying up super late and, you know, it's like 14, 15 year olds like drinking coffee and, you know, barely getting sleep and like that kind of stuff just to test themselves. So I think that you kind of really want to marry that ability to test yourself with some boundaries, because a lot of like, you know, teenagers understandably don't, you know, don't really have boundaries, or they think they do, but they really don't. And it's very easy to overdo it. So I think that, yes, in a sense, I think that it like can be seen as like kind of this like sport, but in the same way that you're not going to let a pitcher pitch every single game, or you're not going to let a basketball player play every minute of like every game, you have to set some like limits on that testing.
Now, Sharif, I'm going to maybe catch you off guard. I didn't warn you I was going to ask you about this. I understand you have some math jokes. Would you be willing to share one or two with us?
I do have some pretty good math jokes, some pretty solid math jokes for you. I don't want to use the 789 because like everyone uses that, but I can say, what did the circle say to the square?
I don't know.
How do you get around?
Good. That's what everybody can appreciate.
This is what people pay for the tutoring for. It's not just the content. It's the jokes.
Well, we'll leave it there. I took us off on a tangent there, but I guess I'll sign off with you now, Sharif. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That was Sharif Jackson, founder of the math and physics tutoring service Math Looks Good LLC. You can watch him on the Dungeons & Dragons live stream Rivals of Waterdeep, where he does occasionally share math jokes.
Governor Scott Walker signed legislation last spring that would close the troubled Lincoln Hills School for boys and Copper Lake School for girls. Both youth prisons face allegations of abuse and neglect from guards, and advocates have argued that bringing kids closer to home will reduce recidivism rates.
Now, Milwaukee County officials are planning for 2021 when both facilities are scheduled to close. Our next guest has been following the story and joins us now with the latest.
Corrine Hess is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Corey, can you briefly give us an overview of some of the issues facing both the Lincoln Hill School for Boys and the Copper Lake School for Girls?
Well, like you said, for years there have been allegations that the inmates there, who are all minors, were being abused and neglected. And early last year, Governor Walker decided that the juvenile jail would be shut down. This is not going to happen, though, until 2021. So it's going to be open for a few more years. And by January of 2021, there's going to be some smaller regional facilities opening up. We're not really sure yet where all those facilities will be. The state is going to run one of them for the most violent offenders. And then there's going to be some other ones run by counties. The only county that we know will be getting one is Milwaukee County. So they're preparing for that right now.
What kind of juvenile offenders will be housed at these facilities? Do we know yet?
We don't really know, but we know that these are the offenders that are nonviolent. They'll probably be about 40 to 50 at these facilities, and they're the ones that probably won't stay more than 6 months. And these facilities are really going to be places where there's going to be rehabilitation programs. The Milwaukee County is talking about having educational programs, workforce training. And the thing about it is it's going to be located in Milwaukee. 65% of the juveniles at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake School for Girls are from Milwaukee County.
I was just going to ask, is that why they're centering one of these residential centers in Milwaukee?
Yes, it is. I mean, the community really wants these youth back where they're from. And this is a way, too, where families can come visit. The center that they're looking at building is going to be on about 5.5 acres of land. There's going to be green space. Talking to county officials, they want families to come and be part of the treatment. They looked at a lot of studies. They think that helps reduce recidivism rates. And they want the community to try to get involved with different mentorship programs. Again, this is all just starting to be looked at, but they really want this to be a place where these youths can try to get their lives back on track.
Corrine Hess is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Milwaukee, and we are talking about the closing of Lincoln Hill Schools for Boys and the Copper Lake Schools for Girls and the future of housing juveniles across the state. Corey, you spoke with Mary Jo Myers, who heads the Department of Health and Human Services for Milwaukee County, and you talked a little bit about some of the goals, some of the county's goals with the facility. What are some of the other things they're looking to do?
Well, I mean, they want to do, their main goal really is to reduce recidivism, but the way that they want to do that is they want to have education opportunities, job opportunities. They want to reach out to the community and form partnerships so that they've got people coming in and showing the youth that there are other options when they get out. They don't have to go back to the types of lives that they were living that got them there in the first place. So that's really their main goal. They also want to make sure that the families are involved. So they're looking at building this in a zip code of Milwaukee where the majority of these youths we're growing up and will return to, most likely.
How long will the juveniles be housed at the proposed site?
You know, in talking to Mary Jo Myers, she said that after about 6 months, that most will be released. So it won't be a long-term thing. Again, these aren't the so-called worst of the worst. They're going to be in a different facility that will still be state-run.
What have you heard from criminal justice advocates in the county about the proposed facility?
You know, I think everyone's looking at this as a new beginning. What happened at Lincoln Hills, in the allegations there, it just can't happen again. So I think they're excited about this. They're excited kind of as starting over. Even in talking to Mary Jo, she said that Milwaukee shouldn't shy away from the fact that every single youth at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake is a person of color, and that Milwaukee doesn't have a great reputation statewide, but that we should really embrace that here in Milwaukee and do better for these families and for these children, really.
Now, you talked about reducing recidivism among young offenders. I imagine by having them close in, for instance, the location, one of the locations being in Milwaukee, and having them maybe close to family as well as county services, that may be a way long term to affect recidivism among young people. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what they're hoping. That is correct. They've looked at other programs nationwide, and I think the belief is, and what they've seen in other states, is that if these youth can get involved in community programs or in workforce development programs and already be, entrenched in their community before they're released, then they've got something to look forward to. They've got something to go to. I think that is a way.
Now, when you talk about the community as a whole, how can the business community be involved with the county and with these centers as far as addressing the issue of recidivism?
You know, that's another thing that the county did talk about, that they'd love to see the business community get involved in this, especially now with unemployment so low and a lot of people saying that they cannot find workers, that they would love for people in the business community to come and meet some of these young people and give them a chance.
Now, building this new residential center is going to be expensive, so has the county talked about how they're going to pay for it?
Well, they have. They have not said how much this is going to cost. The only indication I could get was they thought about renovating one of their facilities, and that was going to cost more than $40 million. And so building new will be less than $40 million. But they are going to apply for a grant through the state, and all they're saying is that the grant won't cover the cost, and they don't know the cost, and that's also being evaluated. So I'm not really sure how this will be paid for. I don't know if anyone's outlined that yet.
Have you seen, at least so far, and obviously money's going to be key to this, but have you seen so far any pushback as far as building this center or building this facility in Milwaukee and the potential cost?
I haven't seen it yet, but again, there hasn't been a site selected. And there hasn't been a cost set. So, you know, time will tell on all of that.
Corey, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Corrine Hess is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Milwaukee. She joins us today to talk about how Milwaukee County officials are planning for the upcoming closure of the Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake youth prisons.
If you have been affected by the Copper Lake and Lincoln Hills story over the years, we'd love to hear from you on what you think of this idea of closing it and opening these smaller facilities. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. And, of course, you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR and share your thoughts. It was Food Friday earlier today. Now we have a food bonus for you. There's a new cookbook in the public domain, all the recipes you want, and the cookbook was just declassified by the CIA in an open records request.
The original cookbook was published in the Soviet Union in 1948. The catchy title of the translated version is Manual for the Cook Instructor of the Ground Troops in Peacetime.
So this is the Field Manual for Teaching Military Cooks. It was translated 6 years later, 1950s, by the CIA, then stayed under wraps, classified, until a Freedom of Information Act request from the transparency website Muckrock.
The manual includes advice for chefs like, quote, the preparation of tasty food is achieved by a strict observance of the rules for the preparation of food.
Makes sense to me. And of course, there are lots of recipes, including borscht, borscht with beet leaves, borscht with sauerkraut, millet borscht. The list goes on and on. Have you tried borscht, Darrell?
I don't even know what borscht is. I've heard of borscht, but I don't know what it is.
I've had it just a couple times. It's beet soup is what it is. It's
beet?
Beet.
Oh.
Yes, beets, and there's evidently a lot of varieties. I've had a couple. Now, if you want borscht, do you like beets?
I do.
Okay.
I like beets.
All right, because, yeah, if you don't like beets, that's a deal breaker. You're not going to like borscht. But even I like beets. Borscht is kind of weird and sweet. I think it's probably an acquired taste. So maybe we could have a borscht night.
Maybe. Well, I like sauerkraut too.
But if you want to find a good borscht recipe, find the people who want to keep like millions of Russian soldiers happy. This is the cookbook to go with. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.